Tonight, we are approaching the 11th of the 11th, the 11th of November, which is a very important date for Rhodesians in particular. But as part of our Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism, Getting the News Behind the News at this Reformation Society, we wanted to note that this coming Sunday is the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended the Great War, or the First World War. And one would wonder, what is the connection between the Armistice 100 and Rhodesia 53 years ago declaring independence on the same date at the same hour? This is the most solemn date in the English-speaking world. In the British world, everything comes to a stop on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, because we remember that when the guns fell silent 100 years ago, at the going down the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. The Memorial Order of the Tin Hats, which started in South Africa, actually began the practice of a moment of silence in remembering the fallen. And it was in Cape Town that the idea of a two-minute silence was first observed. It started after the Battle of the Somme. There was a minute... They asked for 3 minutes of silence in church in Cape Town because of many of the members of the congregation that had lost sons up in the Battle of the Somme, July 1916. Later, when Sir Harry Hands, he was the mayor of Cape Town, his son died in battle in early 1918 in Flanders, up in France. And so he... Asked for a minute of silence to be observed in the church, actually 3 minutes, 1 minute to think of those who have died, another to thank God for those who survived, and then to remember those who are left behind, family, relatives. Well, this was then proposed to use the noonday gun. We already had a noonday gun, which had been operational since about 1812, but the noonday gun now would signify that at the noonday gun, everyone would stop and not move for a full 3 minutes initially. So this is now mid-1918 in Cape Town. And then a bugler would play Reveille at Greenpoint, and then everyone would carry on about their business, whether at workplace or in the street, everyone would stop. Now, Sir Percy Fitzpatrick, who's famous for having been the author of Jock of the Bushveld, he wrote to King George V, Emperor of the British Empire, about this practice being carried out in Cape Town. Here's a rare picture of, see, Slope Stedman, there's Adderley Street, everyone stationary for the, first it was 3 minutes silence, and they later decided to turn to 2 minutes silence to keep people's minds more focused. And so every vehicle stopped, every person stopped or stood by their workbench if they were in the office at that time until the bugle played Reveille. And he wrote to King George V and advised, is it not possible for us to do this empire-wide as they were approaching 1919, November the 11th, which would be the first anniversary of the armistice that ended the First World War. And King George very quickly sent out an order to the entire empire. Everybody throughout the whole empire is to mark on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, 1919, a full 2 minute silence, dead stop where you are. And this was done from Canada through to New Zealand. And here's a rare picture of this being practiced in Cape Town, in Adderley Street, the midday pause. Now, the rest of the empire practiced this on the 11th of the 11th at 11 a.m. Cape Town, consistently, aside from 1919, they practiced it at the noonday. So every noonday, every time noonday gun sounded, people would stop for prayer. But the empire practiced this on one specific day. And I think some parts of the empire did it on other anniversaries. But that's the background to the noonday gun. Now, this was revived throughout the whole country in the Second World War. So this is up in Transvaal, Johannesburg. in 1942, I think, maybe 1943. And this just shows it being practiced in the Transvaal during the Second World War. It was then practiced throughout to pray for the people involved in the war and to think of those who have already fallen. So this then ties into Rhodesia's whole history. They shall not grow old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down the sun and in the morning we will remember them. This is the MOTHS, the Memorial Order of the Tin Hat, which started in South Africa, I believe in Durban, in Old Fort Road. Now, the poppies became symbolic of those who had fallen in the First World War, because in the fields where they fell, in Belgium and in France, which where most of the British Army died, in fact, 85% of the British Army had been killed or crippled or otherwise knocked out of the fight in the first 4 months of the First World War, 1914. Before Christmas 1914, 85% of the British Army was either dead or injured and unable to fight. And they had to raise a totally new army. Where they fell happened to be fields where the poppies grew. And so I remember in the South African Army, they used the term regularly, if you don't do this and if you don't do that, you'll be pushing up poppies. That was meaning you'll get killed if you don't pay attention to this and if you don't do this and so on. So pushing up poppies became another term for people who've died. And the poppies, I think it was a Canadian lady who suggested it, and they first started with silk poppies. But this became, and sometimes they used paper poppies, but this became very much part of every 11th of November worldwide. Interesting how these traditions started in the colonies and the dominions and went to Britain afterwards. And so the 2 minute silence started in South Africa, the poppies from Canada. And, of course, there are memorials throughout the entire English world. You can go to the most remote town and village in Rhodesia, Northern Rhodesia, New Zealand. You'll find memorials to those who died in the First World War. And the poppies tend to be symbolic on the 11th of November. To deny our past is what will, in the end, prevent us from having a future. We've got to know our past. The deeper you lay your foundations, the further the tree or the building can grow. Here, Rhodesian troops departing for action in the First World War, Rhodesian Railways, and Rhodesian soldiers served the British Empire in the First World War. They served in the Second World War. My father was a bombardier in the 8th Army, North Africa, most of it under Field Marshal Montgomery, and in Italy. Here's some Rhodesian troops in the south of Italy in action. And of course, Rhodesia contributed a lot of men to the Royal Air Force. The Rhodesian Royal Air Force included Ian Smith, who was later destined to become Rhodesia's Prime Minister during the hottest part of the war. And he flew Hurricanes and Spitfires. And he endured two crashes, one in North Africa when he was seriously injured. Face was smashed, half his face was plastic surgery, his back he thought was broken, but turned out to only be buckled. And as he put it, he later was shot down in Italy while revving up a train on a second run. And so Rhodesia provided some sterling air fighters, and that will explain something about the flag later. There's a picture of Ian Smith after being shot down. He joined the partisans. He is behind enemy lines for 5 months. He later crossed the Alps on foot. And as he said, he made one of the worst mistakes in his life. He took his boots off one night, and the next morning he couldn't fit his feet back in the boots. They had frozen solid. And so he had to walk in his stockings, in his socks, carrying his boots because he couldn't get these boots back on his feet in the Alps. You don't take off your boots in the Alps, apparently, to get into France after he heard of D-Day to go and rejoin. And he is flying Spitfires before the end of the war again. This is the victory parade in 1946 in London. You can see the Queen Mother. Well, then she would have been the Queen. Meeting with Rhodesian airmen, and here are some of the Rhodesian sailors and soldiers and airmen taking the march past. Then King George V actually visited Rhodesia, 1947, visited South African Rhodesia to thank these parts of the empire for their contributions during the war in particular. In the Malayan conflict, Rhodesians were mobilized again. Interesting, looking at these high school students, that's their high school outfits. I don't know what you think, but they look older than our matrix look these days. They obviously grew up quicker, I suppose, the farm and everything else like that. But heading off to Malaya, here you can see this person still wearing his school uniform. He's got his rifle, got his kit, and he's heading off to Malaya, where they relaunched the Rhodesian Sea Squadron Special Air Service. And here are others in training. So when it comes to the 11th of November, we have the poppies, we have the candle. Normally you switch off all lights here and you have one candle in your house on the 11th of November. Now, I've been to Ypres, where most British soldiers who died in all the wars are buried. Within a 10-kilometer radius of Ypres, you have got something in reach of 156 cemeteries. And most British soldiers who've died in all the wars died in and around Ypres in Belgium, especially in those hideous wars, in the first war, the battles one after the other. This is one of the memorials I saw set up 85 years after the event by Australians, the Khaki Chums. So this is 1995. They set up this, lest we forget, with a football, remembering the Christmas truce. When in 1914, at the Christmas Eve, both sides, whether it was Australians, New Zealanders, Canadians, English, Scottish, Welsh, French, and Germans, were singing Christmas carols, played soccer with one another. And so 85 years after the event, some people came from Australia and put this memorial up. And if you've seen the film Joyeux Noël, you'll remember there's Felix the Cat. Well, this is one of his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren, I guess. Even this cat was there. Extraordinarily well worth seeing film. Now, when you look beyond, you see that church steeple. In that church steeple, the most famous individual to ever be gassed was cared for during the 4 months that he was blind. That's Adolf Hitler. He fought at this front right opposite these folks. And he was all 4 years. Interesting enough, Churchill was there for a few months as well. Two painters on opposite sides. It would have been nice if they both stuck to painting instead of going to politics. The Christmas truce, extraordinary, amazing thing. All over Belgium, you will see war cemeteries to British and Empire soldiers who died here, of different regiments, different units. And as you go through, you can even see, I don't know if you can actually tell here, but there is a 14-year-old boy. No, here's the 15-year-old. They accepted youngsters, 13, 14, 15, coming into the army, pushed them at the front. And this is Rifleman Strudwick, who was killed at age 15, which today would be considered a war crime to put children into battle, but they were doing it at that stage without thinking about it. In fact, the Royal Navy has a tradition of putting children into people like Lord Nelson. I think from age 10, he was serving on battleships. And that was not unusual. If you've seen films like Master and Commander, where you can see children involved in the battles and commanding and so on, that was not unusual. You'd get an admiral, send his child in at 10 or so to join the Navy, and he would be expected to do everything. And that included having their arms cut off when they need amputations and all the rest. Quite horrific. This is Menin Gate, on which are written the names of vast amounts of British soldiers. Ypres was a massive bastion, huge stronghold, strong walls. And so at these gates, they have got the names of the British soldiers for whom they couldn't find the bodies. If they have a body, they've got a grave. If they don't have, they couldn't find the body because of artillery killed 85% of all the soldiers in the First World War. They have a name on the wall. And every day, every single night, last post is sounded, and the people gather from all over. And I was staggered. I started counting the amount of Hammonds I could see on the walls, and they were a lot. In fact, I counted something like 156 Hammonds on the walls. And finally, the place I went to, just around Ypres. So I went to the British and Commonwealth War Graves records, and they informed me 480 Hammonds died on the British side in the First World War. Staggering. I was also quite surprised to see that 12 Hammonds died in action Anglo-Boer War as well. So our people are all over the place. So they've had last post every night at Menin Gate, and different people gather. This is just when I was there. And I took these pictures of the different units that come. People come from all over. Relatives, people whose grandfather died there maybe, or great-grandfather in some cases. And all around, you see, this is a very typical British war memorial. It's got a cross with a sword in the cross. That's uniquely First World War memorials. These walls are huge, and these graveyards are massive. And remember, the people whose names are on the walls are the ones that don't have a grave. This is the Irish Regiment. Notice these special towers. The Irish built these to run into and hide when the Vikings came, because they'd burn everything else, destroy everything else. So people climbed up. They might have a ladder that reached up to the entrance there, and they'd pull a ladder in or something like that, and then they would watch while the Vikings destroyed everything else, and they would... Yes, so here you can see this is uniquely Irish. And the Irish 36th Ulster Division lost 32,000 men killed, wounded, or missing. On the first day of the Battle of the Somme, they lost a colossal amount. It was absolutely staggering. I think on the first day across the whole front in the Somme, and the Battle of the Somme lasted for 4 months. Ulster lost something in the region of 20-odd thousand men killed on the first day of the battle. And when you think that the people came from a single town or village, you could have all the men in an entire town killed in one battle, in 1 hour, actually. And which is why in the Second World War they broke people up in different places to kind of minimize the damage to one particular group. But the Irish, what they suffered, absolutely colossal. So that would be the entrance. And this is from underneath looking up. Now, of course, this is an idealized one made at part of the memorial, but just reminding that there were different floors and all of that. Then you go to Langemark on the other side, and you see the German war cemetery of those who died on the other side. And almost everywhere I saw three crosses, marking the cross of Christ, and then the two thieves who died on each side of him. And for the four branches of the service, they've got memorial there. And this would be, of course, Army, Air Force, Navy, and Medical Corps. And for the fallen and the names. And I couldn't help but notice there were quite a few Lindemans there, my mother's family. So my father's side and my mom's side losing people at the same battle site. And yet, Hammonds and Lindemans had fought together at the Battle of Waterloo against the common enemy of the French. So this sparked my interest, wanting to know, well, why did the greatest friends of all fight one another in two wars when Germans and British had always been allies? In fact, the royal family in Britain's totally German. Queen Victoria, if you've seen the film Young Victoria, you might have noticed how Prince Albert is struggling to speak English. That's fiction. They spoke German to one another all the time. They brought up the children speaking German in Buckingham Palace. They never bothered to speak English to one another. They always spoke German. Queen Victoria was totally German. So was Prince Albert. So this business of him struggling to communicate to her in English is just for the movies, really. But how was it that the best of allies ended up becoming the best of enemies? Here you can see at Langemark the reef there. I've called you by name, you are mine. Isaiah 43, verse 1. Now, you can tell when you go to the battlefields which are the British or Allied and which are the German. The British ones are the ones lined with corrugated iron. They weren't lined with corrugated iron at the time. It was wood, but the wood would perish. So for the purposes of the memorials, they've put the corrugated iron to keep it there because the wood would perish over the years. But notice immediately the British ones are linear. They're very straight lines, but they will change direction because if a bomb falls in the trench, you don't want the whole trench to get wiped out. So they would angle it. And then, of course, you've got a place where people could hide if there's rain and so on. But this is Hill 60. This changed sides a lot of times. And a lot of ordnance is still around there. And you can go and you can see the remnants of a tree shot to pieces by artillery with the poppies and the crosses with prayers and sometimes names of people there that have been put there by their grandchildren. Now, this is obviously German lines. German lines were all with wicker type of, also you can see how they had a drainage system. They had planks to walk on while the Allies were slopping around the mud. And they would have sandbags at the top. They did have wooden on the side. And they were always curved, continually curved. So the Allies angled sort of almost at right angles, whereas the German ones were more curved. And so immediately you can tell just by looking whether it's German trenches like these are or Allied trenches. If you've read All Quiet on the Western Front, then you remember the windmill. This is the windmill. The windmill was one of the worst places to be because, of course, for gunners, it was something very prominent, so they could angle, they could sight, they could... So if you went near the windmill, this was just a death strip for anyone near it, trying to go anywhere near the windmill. The Canadians have their monument at St. Julian. You can see the Canadian type helmet and the memorial and... Here you can see the different memorials for Belgians, for the Cobbers. This is for the Australians. For the Scottish. This looks like Canadians, very much Canadians on this occasion. And many different types of memorials. I've got one of these First World War bayonets. They cost a fortune in a antique store. Do you know at the end of the First World War, they took 10 million or more, something like 11 to 14 million of these bayonets, and mixed them in with concrete. Because we'll never need bayonets again. It's the war that's ended all wars. Very few people kept them, and those ones are worth a fortune now. Like at the end of the Rhodesian War, there were a lot of people who put their Rhodesian camouflage into the furnace, into the boiler, not knowing how valuable they would be later. You can see memorials like this. To the glory of God, this memorial was erected by the parishioners in grateful remembrance of those who fell in the Great War. You can go to a lot of churches, especially in Britain, and even South Africa, and you will see memorials to the members of that congregation or school. Go down to bishops. They've got these lines. They love duty more than they fear death. I remember seeing at my school, Milton, also the honors board of many, many names of people who from Milton High School who had died in the First World War, and the Second as well. And so all over the world, you've got these memorials and people gathering for some of the memorials as they're being set. And it's just staggering when you pass row after row after row of headdresses with names. This is an entire generation of people wiped out. For what? You can't question the courage of these people, but the wisdom of the politicians who sent them there and refused any chance of peace earlier over and over and over, one can certainly question the politicians a lot because this war, in many senses, has never ended. Because the Versailles Treaty not just ended the First World War, it guaranteed the Second. Absolutely guaranteed a whole century of warfare. And in a sense, the guns of August have never been silent. We've been at war ever since. Here's Russia remembering their side of it with their memorials. And you can think of how many horses died in this war. This is one of the most tragic things, too, that it's bad enough for people to die because of our stupidity and wickedness, but for animals to die because of our wickedness. Here's a whole lot of horseshoes put together as a memorial to the animals who died in the war, the horses. And there were also dogs who were trained to take medical aid to the people who were between lines, so could carry, say, morphine, bandages, and so on. And these dogs would run out to people in the between lines to take them some medical aid because no medic could dare do it. and how many of these war dogs died in this horrible war. The South African unit that was at Delville Wood even had a Springbok there. And sadly, that Springbok did not survive the war. Although this is after the Delville Wood battle. The Springbok survived the Battle of Delville Wood, died sometime afterwards. But shocking to even think that you would send an animal up there or send people there. At Delville Wood, South Africa's got a section which is built like the castle in shape. And if that looks familiar to you, that shape, I'll show you later why it is very familiar. These are South Africans who fell in Delville Wood. We sent in something like 2,600 men, and just a couple of hundred came out. We lost thousands of men in there, the Springbok Legion. And these are some of the memorials in France, remembering in the Battle of the Somme. So if you go to Union Buildings, you'll see a replica of what's at Delville Wood. And this is a memorial to those who died in the First World War. It may not immediately be obvious to everyone that that's its intention. So the poppies, the 11th of November, lest we forget, the candle being left. It was often a practice putting a candle by the empty seat at the family's dinner table. So this is my home on the 11th of November, 1914, where even where all over the English-speaking world, people put out all lights in the home and just had a candle going. Do you remember? And that's my father's helmet from the Second World War, North Africa. Well, in 1914, the war began on the 4th of August. It became a world war when Britain declared war on Germany, because until then it was just a European war. Serbia attacked Austria, Austria attacked Serbia. Russia attacked Austria, Germany moved against Russia to support Austria, France moved against Germany. This was going to be a couple of months, pretty obvious who was going to win, and boundaries would shift a little and everyone would go back to peace a few months later. I mean, that was pretty straightforward. But when Great Britain entered it with the entire empire, including Rhodesia, and South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, and Canada, well, that changed it into a world war. Because now with the British Navy, now suddenly South Africa is attacking Southwest Africa and we're ending up in German East Africa, which is Tanzania. And who knows what, and before you know it, there's Gallipoli and the poor Anzacs are losing people by the tens of thousands for a pointless attack on the most fortified position possible to force the Dardanelles, one of Churchill's follies. And so this became a world war that lasted 4 years, more than 4 years. So in August, July and August 2014, on the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War, I was invited to England to speak at a number of conferences and visit the new First World War Memorial at the British Imperial War Museum. And I saw the beginning of one of the most remarkable memorials, a living memorial. And this is Seas of Red poppies being planted in the moat around the tower. Blood-swept lands and seas of red. 888,246 ceramic red poppies, each intended to represent one British or colonial imperial serviceman killed in the war. 888,000. And so every day, volunteers were planting these poppies, and every night, last post would sound, and they would read out the names of people who had died in the war. And this was from 4th of August 2014 to 11th of November 2014. Each one of these poppies was actually bought by somebody and later collected for £10 each. So actually, they made it a self-funding, and most of the profits went then to the, or all the profits went to service pensioners and war-related charities. And you could see how it started. Now, this tower is the first building built by the Normans, the Vikings who took England in 1066. So this white tower was the first building, and of course they added to it. How many heroes of the faith died in here? Like Queen Jane, the nine-day queen at age 16, beheaded for refusing to renounce her Protestant faith, and many others. So this also represented the flying section, those who died in the air, the airmen. And this kept growing and staggering. I mean, I don't know what other people thought, but when I saw this, I saw red. I couldn't help but be impressed by the magnitude of the amount of people who died in the war. But my anger for the politicians who sent them, for what purpose? Who benefited, aside from the Soviet Union, international communism, the banksters, and other evil people? But we must honor the people who made the sacrifice. Their courage, their integrity is without question. But the politicians who are responsible, it's oceans of blood. The different units represented, different flags, different arms of the services, absolutely staggering. And it's not finished yet. And as it approaches, every night people came, they said something in the region of 4 million or more people came to hear the names being read out at night. And what an impact. Oceans of blood from the air. Can you imagine? Here, even from this distance, you can see that red around the Tower of London. This is something we were part of too, because Rhodesia contributed more men, percentage of its population, in both the First and Second World War than any other part of the British Empire. And therefore, when Ian Smith and his government chose in 1965, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, to declare its independence from Britain, the British government was more outraged over the timing than over the facts of Britain declaring independence. I mean, Britain was doing the same thing that the United States did back in 1776. They declared unilateral declaration of independence 4th of July. However, there was no United Nations or Commonwealth around then. And Rhodesia's declaration, you notice, it ends with God Save the Queen. Rhodesia was a monarchy, a constitutional monarchy. And therefore, and by the way, let it be reminded, Rhodesia was never a British colony. Rhodesia was self-supporting, self-governing, self-defending from the beginning. Britain never put a penny or a pound into Rhodesia before Lord Soames came for the occupation, for that transition, which ended up to be a betrayal and a handover. But Rhodesia was, in fact, it should have been a dominion because it was totally self-funding. No other British overseas possession could be described as self-supporting from the beginning. But it was. And so Rhodesia declared its independence at that time. Why? To remind Britain, we fought for you in the First and the Second World War and in Malaya, and now we attacked by terrorists and you supporting the terrorists and you sanctioning us. And so the timing of it was super symbolic. And here the 25 pounders, what was my dad's traditional weapon, being used in Cecil Square, announcing Rhodesia's independence. These Rhodesians died for Britain. We will remember them. I mean, the symbolism of that, and this is why Britain was so super furious, or I should say the British government was super furious. That is why the flag under which Rhodesia declared its independence, we have an example in our reception, you can look at it, is blue. It's got the Union Jack in the top left corner. It's got the Rhodesian badge, which has the lion, and it's got the Proteas, but it's got the golden pick, because miners were the ones who settled it. Cecil Rhodes' British South Africa Company were after gold, and they went up there to hunt, to explore for minerals, and of course green for the land. But the blue predominates over the land. It's Air Force blue, to remind again, we contributed so many men for the Royal Air Force, through the Rhodesian Royal Air Force. Notice here you can see the different colored hands lifting up the Rhodesian flag, which is the independent flag. Most people think the independent flag was the green-white, but that only came in 1970 when Rhodesia became a republic. And so Ian Smith on the cover of Sly magazine. Now this is a principled man, honorable man, a man of integrity, a man of his word. He said what he meant what he said. He was the first Rhodesian-born Prime Minister of Rhodesia. You can see Independence, the Prime Minister's residence, the Liberty Bell. We have struck a blow for justice, civilization, and Christianity. Ian Smith's words at Independence. I don't know how many other countries could have a head of state who would be cycling to work, walking to work, catching the train. This is a very down-to-earth, humble man. And I had the opportunity of seeing Ian Smith when I was a young boy of 14. I heard he's coming to Bulawayo Club. My father's the manager of the Bulawayo Club. So I was waiting outside and I was expecting to see an entourage, you know, something spectacular. Here's the Prime Minister coming. And down the road came this beat-up old Peugeot 404. Out got the Prime Minister. There was no policeman. There was no adjutant. There wasn't a driver. There wasn't a chauffeur. Nothing. I couldn't see a policeman in sight. Here we were during the war, 1974. I was 14 years old. Rhodesia was in the middle of this horrific war, apparently. And the Prime Minister's driving unescorted. He stroked my cat that was sitting on the wall, Tim. Smiled at me. Walked up the steps into the Bulawayo Club. And I looked around. Where are the bodyguards? Where are the police? So I later brought this up to him and asked, you know, why is it that you didn't have bodyguards around him? And he said, I survived the Second World War. What do I need to fear? He said, I'm a lifelong Presbyterian. I fear God. And he said he often broke his own government's rules by going without escort, without being in a convoy, down to his farm near Siliqui, near Gwelo, what today is Gweru. And he couldn't be bothered waiting for others. He'd regularly chase away everyone out of the Independence. There wasn't a cook in the kitchen or a policeman at the gates because he said he couldn't bother with people fussing around him. Now, this is Ian Smith. When I've seen him at his home, doors open, front gates wide open, Rhodesian Ridgeback lying over the threshold of the door, and that's about it. And Ian Smith himself would make the tea. And he had this massive teacup. I'd never seen anything so big. And he says, oh, these civilian teacups are so small. So his daughter got fed up with him complaining and got a specially made big, massive teacup for him. Sort of like a military fire bucket size. So in 1970, Rhodesia was forced to declare itself a republic. Now, Rhodesians didn't want to be a republic. People like my father were serious monarchists. My father was such a monarchist, he could never vote for Ian Smith's Rhodesian Front, even though he supported him and everything, just because of the fact that he had declared a country a republic. And so my father, who would host him and be respectful, but he is like, oh, he's got to support the monarchist side, because to him, Rhodesia had to be under the Queen. But as Ian Smith explained it, we had to declare ourselves a republic because the Queen was the head of state and she was pardoning every single terrorist, mass murdering criminal that was sentenced to death by the Supreme Court. And of course, as head of state, it was her prerogative, and so that had to be honored. But in order to have consequences for capital crimes, they had to become a republic so that they had their own president as head of state. You couldn't have the Queen listening to British Parliament and British Foreign Office interfering in Rhodesia's security in the middle of a war. So for some people in Rhodesia, like my father, this flag grated them. I loved this flag. My brother loved this flag. My father detested it because it represented a turning away from being a monarchy, constitutional monarchy. You can see the Rhodesian badge. It's got the very mysterious Zimbabwe bird. It's got the helmet of a knight. Speaking about some of the heraldry of the past, there's the lion, which has always been a British symbol. And there's the sable antelope. The sable antelopes have the sharpest horns of any buck. And they can put their horns straight through the side of a Land Rover. Those are very sharp horns. You don't want to play with those. Very impressive. This is an everything dignity. That's the motto. Ian Smith's vision always was of a country that was not a white government or black majority government, but a country of partnership. In fact, his term was responsible government. And he spoke about qualified franchise. And anyone could have the vote, black or white, by the same standard, which is educational standard or property ownership. And so you applied for the right to vote and you had to be qualified. So not every white person could vote. Many black people could. And he wanted a parity. He wanted 50-50%. And unfortunately, the terrorists started intimidating, murdering, and one by one candidates for parliament, chiefs, mayors, and others were being murdered and intimidated so that less and less black people were involved in the Rhodesian government. But that wasn't the policy of the Rhodesian government. That was the terrorism tactics of the, well, they first were called the ANC, and then they later became ZANU and ZAPU as they split into Zimbabwe African National Union of Mugabe and the Zimbabwe African People's Union of Nkoma. But Ian Smith was always someone who was beloved by the black people. In fact, when his farm was invaded, he later said, "Oh, I'm not worried. I've still got more black friends in Zimbabwe than Mugabe has. I challenge Mr. Mugabe, come and join me. Let's walk down Samora Machel Avenue without his bodyguards. Let's see who gets the other side alive." And I mean, that's a fact. He would be mobbed in the streets by the people. They loved him. They carried him on his shoulders. Rhodesia. Magnificent country. Huge country. Very small population. Very wild country. When you came there, you felt welcome. Just the wildness of it. And the magnificent roads, the view, the spectre, this was a wilderness. And they brought civilization here in very short order. And what a magnificent country. The Nyanga Highlands and the wildlife, some of the most magnificent. I loved going to Wanky Game Reserve. And the first rule of the road we were taught at school, elephants have right of way. And that made sense to me. Elephants have right of way, yes. And in fact, those signs aren't just a joke. They were there. These are some of the posters advertising Southern Rhodesia. Remember, Zambia's Northern Rhodesia, Southern Rhodesia, before the Federation broke up, was known as Southern Rhodesia, or SR. And the Jubilee celebrations, notice the BSAP, the British South Africa Police uniform, they were the senior service, because they were the first service. This Eastern Gateway to Southern Rhodesia, Umtali, has a whole lot of Portuguese conquistors, and you can actually see the Portuguese priest traveling there, and these men, these conquistador helmets. That's because back 500 years ago, in the days of Monomotapa, the Portuguese came from Beira and they marched in their uniforms with their armor, can you believe it, into Rhodesia, and they all died of malaria. I can only feel sorry for these poor souls in those hot, unbelievable metal uniforms. But still, the Portuguese were there. So, back in 1893, 94, was it? Cecil John Rhodes ordered his man, who is the first administrator of Rhodesia, Leander Starr Jamieson, take Manicaland from the Portuguese. Now, this was super illegal because Britain was an ally of Portugal. In fact, the British government was seriously allied to Portugal, and the Portuguese were considered their friends. And the royal family had some connection with the monarch of Portugal too. So he did this super undercover. And when the British found out about it, they sent a telegram to him from the Foreign Office, cease and desist immediately. And he told his men to please cut the telegraph wire. And Leander Starr Jamieson said, tell me when you've got the whole of Nyanga, all the highlands, overlooking the Vumba and so on. It overlooks Mozambique, Portuguese, East Africa. And once it got it, then he allowed the telegram to be delivered to him and then ordered them to stop in accordance with the British instructions. But that's the way that the empire operated. And Cecil Rhodes had his own set of rules. And that's why Manicaland is Rhodesian and not Mozambican. Here you can see, you can still go through Masvingo today and see the Fort Victoria Tower, which was set up by the British South Africa Police. And you can see here Madibili Warrior, symbolizing Rhodesia. In the sun, Rhodesia. Now, it's this kind of poster that persuaded my father after the Second World War to choose to be demobilized. You could be demobilized anywhere in the empire, and he chose Rhodesia because he wanted to be in the sun. He learned to like the sun, being in North Africa and Egypt, Libya and Italy. And so it always amused my brother and I that our dad would speak about England as home. I mean, we'd never been to England. I mean, what do you mean home? Rhodesia's home. And he'd say England's home. So I remember my brother saying, well, Dad, why don't you live in England? My father said, oh, you can't live in England. Well, it's terrible. Awful. He wanted to be out in the sun. But I mean, that's typical of many of the people who came to Rhodesia. England might have been home, but they couldn't live there. I mean, they were in the sun. And so this was the main reason why many people came to Rhodesia. And that's why the Rhodesian Air Force was so effective, because there were so many days of sun, they could train all year round. And so many of the Royal Air Force came out to get their training in South Africa or Rhodesia because they couldn't train that much, certainly not in winter in England. Of course, the farmlands were famous, and all Rhodesians know about Tanganda tea. I mean, that's just, as I said, it's pure Rhodesian. And the farmers there were super, super effective. I mean, extraordinary. This was interesting. This is called World Plowing Contest. And it's pointing out the old wooden plow, which could barely feed one subsistence family. And then when you start to have plows pulled by oxen, all the way through to now the modern tractor, one farmer can feed over 60 families and so on. And so World Plowing Contest. And yep, there is no doubt about it. Commercial farmers have the technology that enables us to live in a city. You couldn't, most people in the world were agricultural subsistence farmers for most of history. It's in my lifetime that the world has moved to be mostly urbanized, because until modern technology like the tractors and irrigation techniques, most people had to be involved in agriculture. Very few people could afford to be in the cities. And that's why we're about to discover in this country what they've learned in Zimbabwe and others, that if you don't have a farmer, you can't survive in a city. It's got to be not a subsistence farmer, a commercial farmer, one who can feed hundreds of families more than his own. And that is something they don't appreciate what's involved in making, especially a country that's pretty wilderness, where thorn bushes are the natural growth, and making it bloom for agriculture. Well, we grew up with all kinds of great books and interesting adventure books and Rhodesian adventure. And these were, it was an adventurous country. We loved the strip roads, to just travel on these roads, and you travel for miles and miles without seeing another car. I remember traveling to Fort Victoria or up to Victoria Falls, and it was exciting when you saw another car coming. And then you'd move onto your left wheel would go off the road and your right wheel would be on the left lane, and you'd wave frantically as the others passed and you'd go back on. And it was an economical way of traveling around. In fact, I believe for many people, they found the strip roads have done better than some of the new roads they've built. And this is what we saw. Not just zebra crossings, but giraffe crossings. The tallest animals in the world. Magnificent creatures. Where else in the world could you have a giraffe in your swimming pool? I mean, I grew up feeling sorry for these poor souls brought up in Europe and America without wildlife all around them. Well, what poor deprived creatures. Isn't this great? You know, some people said in Rhodesia we're in the middle of nowhere. No, we were in the middle of everywhere. I mean, it's only 6,000 kilometers to the pyramids and 2,772 to Mount Kilimanjaro, and Cape Town's only 3,000 k's that way, and so on. So we were in the middle of everywhere, you know. It was great.
And cold beer.
Yeah, where? Yes, cold beer is very close. That's right. That's like 163 meters. So the Clouds End Hotel. So this is just typical Rhodesia, Makuti. And Birchenough Bridge, very typically Rhodesian. And Victoria Falls. To be at Victoria Falls, where David Livingstone crawled to the edge. I mean, he paddled in his dugout canoe, lodged it amidst white water on what is today called Livingstone Island, and crawled to the edge and measured it out. So the Queen was part of our stamps. You can see the little Rhodesian plane, the big South African plane. I mean, that's pretty typical. Big brother, South Africa. We knew that we were a small neighbor. There was the sense that in Rhodesia, everything was just better. And we could walk onto the planes. And I remember the air stewardess. We didn't have flight tents. We had stewardesses. And I said, please ensure that your firearms are on safety and securely holstered, and rifles and shotguns in the overhead compartments. No Air Rhodesia was ever hijacked. And what other airline had stewardesses like this and cheaters? I mean, Jesus, wow. And you could have a 5-day all-expenses-paid holiday in a hotel at Victoria Falls for $175. I mean, wow. Kariba Dam. When this was built in the 50s, I saw an article written in 1956 in a magazine I was searching through, and was speaking about Rhodesia showing the way. By 1970, all of Africa can be electrified. Every home can have electricity, every factory, just from the hydroelectric capacity of the Congo River alone. You could provide electricity for the whole of Africa. And they were predicting by 1970, all of Africa being electrified. which was not unrealistic in 1956. But something happened in 1960 that derailed it all, handing over to Marxist mass-murdering thugs and criminals. So Eredesia, Victoria Falls, can you imagine? That's Livingston Island. Here's David Livingston coming along in his dugout canoe. He's got to collide there. You don't want to go over the edge. That's like a one-way trip. And he saw the most amazing thing. That's Livingston Island right there. You don't want to miss it, because there's Livingston Island. This is 1,600 meters wide, 310 feet high. And wow, just absolutely staggering. That's Livingston Island again. They've got a good view of Livingston Island.
This
is the Zambezi River. And so what David Livingston is doing is he's coming down and basically at the Zambian side, landed on this, went to the edge, crawled to the edge, looked out, measured down 310 feet on his weighted rope and things like that. And how he worked out the width, I have no idea because you can't exactly pace it. But that's Livingston Island. That just gives you a bit of a feel. Look how it sort of dips in. You don't want to crawl to the edge of that if you've got a fear of heights. That's for sure. The rainbow, to see Victoria Falls at night is an extraordinary experience. And to be out in a thunder cloud, especially November, the thunderstorms. And what incredible wildlife, what phenomenal wildlife. From the wildebeest, the buffaloes. Buffaloes you don't want to get on the wrong side of. These chaps are serious. And elephants always have right of way, back up. And when you see this on the road, back up. Zebras, fish eagles. I've camped on the banks of the Zambezi River and woken up to hippos grazing around my sleeping bag and hearing a cry of fish eagle, looking and seeing this fish eagle pluck a fish out of the Zambezi, and I'm still lying in my sleeping bag. Where in the world can you buy opportunities like that? And I didn't pay a thing for it. All over the world, people praised Rhodesian wildlife conservation. We had some of ours was a nature sanctuary. From the smallest little creatures like the bush baby to the fastest like the cheetah to these gentle giants. And Wanky Game Reserve was what, and we had everything from small, medium, and large. And the big tuskers. And one story that really gripped me early on, and you can Google the pictures. It's there's a film on Operation Noah, and Rhodesian game rangers went on a massive spree in 1950s to save all animals in the area that was to be flooded by the Kariba Dam when it got built. And how they, I remember seeing the pictures of these game rangers stopping at, there's this tree and there's a whole bunch of snakes, and they're pulling these snakes off this tree onto themselves in this boat to get them off, and thinking, these people are brave. Wow. Couldn't imagine wanting to do that. Yep. Little baby having swimming lessons. Hippos have right of way. In water, hippos have right of way. Look at those teeth. You don't want to argue with this chap. And in the water, they definitely have right of way. Agility helps. See this impala, and there's a crocodile coming out the water. Being able to move quickly can make the difference between life and death. But what's also interesting is how there's interconnectivity between animals and how you can get interspecies cooperation, like tick birds doing a whole lot of work to get rid of the ticks that there's no way this poor rhino can reach all those spots. And here you can see some impala getting a thorough spa treatment down at the river. Yeah, obviously feels very good. And these warthogs, notice the size of the warthog, notice the size of this crocodile. This crocodile is over 5 meters, crossing the road and so on, but you don't want to argue with a crocodile. Or the leopard. The highlight of my life was going to the Mushendike Bush School. It was part of our Rhodesian schooling. We'd be sent off to the bush school and trained by game rangers how to survive in the bush. And tracking, anti-tracking, everything, water, the whole lot, you know, how to survive in the bush. And I remember him saying, look, there's a lot of leopards around here. He said, we don't mind you feeding the animals, but your parents would. It took a while for me to work out what he's saying. And he said, you may not see the leopards, but they'll see you. And again, sticks in my mind. You may not see the leopard, but in his territory, he sees you. These guys are quiet. And then there's the lions. These are the kings. Lions also have right of way. And that's a great place to rest off. This is a sanctuary too. I must say, to grow up around wildlife and to see wildlife. I remember walking outside of Bulawayo as a 12-year-old, walking to Kami Ruins, which was 14 miles out of town. My parents said, and I was walking to Kami Ruins on a Saturday morning. As long as I was home before the sunset, that was fine. And on the way, I saw wildebeest, giraffe, rhino. That wasn't a game park. That was just outside the city limits. It was just magnificent. But we had the most magnificent animals. And I had a lioness, Vivian, as my best friend when I was growing up. These are the kings and queens. And these game rangers, what a magnificent, outstanding, tremendous job they did. And going to Zimbabwe ruins and looking at this and trying to puzzle out how this happened, what it was built for and all this, really, your imagination ran riot. King Solomon's mines, Queen of Sheba's and all the rest of it. But the wilderness was turned into a place of fountains. This is Cecil Square in Salisbury, and you can see the cathedral, All Saints Cathedral. Salisbury, 1960. You know, the first thing you know is, I never saw a traffic jam in Rhodesia. Well, except at the waterhole sometimes with some animals, the elephants coming. But in the streets were wide. And absolutely amazing how absolutely, you can see the church cathedral there in Cecil Square. Gives you an idea. When I walked to school through Centenary Park in Bulawayo, I went down streets lined with jacaranda trees, and jumping on the jacaranda poppies was absolutely delightful. And the smell, it was just beautiful. You'd walk in the shade smelling jacarandas and jumping on the poppies. I think people in Pretoria get that chance too. And the Matopos and Leopard Rock Hotel in Umtali. This is just absolutely tremendous. I'm so glad Cecil Rhodes took this from the Portuguese. Much nicer that it was in Rhodesian hands. And we had the warthogs as groundsmen trimming the lawn. The pennies in Rhodesia used to have a hole in the middle. And the reason was because the average tribesman didn't have pockets. And so they could put it in a string and string it around. They could carry the money on a string. So that's the purpose of the holes. I remember that 10 shillings. When you got a 10 shilling with a sable antler, you had a lot of money. This could last you a while. You could really do a lot with that. This is real money. This year is worth more than a $100 trillion note in 2008. Could buy a lot more with it. A dollar. You could, for $2 in 1977, get a three-course steak meal in a top-class restaurant in Salisbury. I seldom had a $5 note in my hand. I mean, that's just a lot of money. As for $10, wow. I mean, this is worth a lot more than our 200 Rand ones now. In fact, a whole bunch of them. This could buy more than what? This is probably more than what 10,000 Rand could buy you today. We didn't need Disney World or anything like that. We had Mermaid's Pool. We had real, genuine fun out there. Why would you need to go to these fake things that they've got at McDonald's and so on when we had the real deal? Swimming in the dams was just the best. So we've got a great heritage. And the man who walked across it and first proclaimed the gospel was David Livingstone, the first messenger of the gospel in the 1850s already, passing through Rhodesia. And here, this was at the 100th anniversary of David Livingstone sighting it, 1955. So on the 100th anniversary, on the 16th of November, they opened this up, which committed the people of southern Rhodesia to continue the high ideals of David Livingstone and furthering Christianity and civilization. That's in the plaques down below. And Robert Moffat not only proclaimed the gospel to the Matabele, but his son built the first mission station amongst the Matabele. And Frederick Salu, the man after whom Salu scouts were named. The premier service in Rhodesia always was the British South Africa Police. They were the private army of Cecil John Rhodes. Cecil John Rhodes here's a statue. You can see it downtown in the gardens in Cape Town. Go north, young man. Your future is in the north. Your hinterland is there. And he's pointing north. And many people took that advice, including my father. But the Matabele were there. Zulus. Tough warriors. Queen Victoria gave a charter to Cecil Rhodes to set up this country in the name of the Queen by his British South Africa Police, British South Africa Company, crossing Limpopo, 1890. And that was pretty rough terrain. We're talking about going over it with ox wagons. There's no roads to speak of. There were no bridges. And they raised the Union Jack in 1890 over what today was called Harare, what then was called Salisbury. This is the British South Africa Company's flag. It's Union Jack with an adaption. And they built fast and furiously. And this is in 1898, just in 8 years, this is what Salisbury began to look like. And you can see everything from the mills and the churches and the halls and the shops. But still, they are traveling like this. This is in 1904. This is how the Matabele seemed, wearing very little clothes, very much aggressive. Here the Mashonaland Volunteers. Later they became the British South Africa Police, the first called the Mashonaland Mounted Police. During the 1893 war with the Matabele kept raiding the Shona as their slaves, and they said, we can do what we want with the Shona, and the Rhodesians felt obligated to protect the Shona, and so the first war, the Matabele War, broke out. And here you can see the kind of people that were in the lagers, in this case in Bulawayo, and some of these tough characters, British South Africa Police, or they were then called Mashonaland Mounted Police, and their forts, their wagons, lagers, battles, the Shangani Patrol, Major Alan Wilson. They sang God Save the Queen before they died. They were heard praying the Lord's Prayer. Some of the Matabele who came to the Lord later recognized that when they were taught it. And the Matabele came into town afterwards and surrendered, because they said, if these young boys could fight like men, what will happen when their fathers come for revenge? We want peace now. The best book I've read on them, Alan Wilson's patrol, was The White Men Sang. Extraordinary. Their memorial at World's View in Matopos. At first, they looked like banditos, actually. But later, the British South Africa Police got very polished, very organized and pristine. And they trained local askari. And here at Salisbury Depot, kits inspection, the Barutsi, that's way out in western Zambia, what today's western Zambia then was Barutsi land or northern Rhodesia, a bayonet drill. And they were building pretty significant. This is 1896. They'd only come to Bulawayo in 1893. They were building to last early on. And here's Cecil Rhodes establishing the shops. This is already 1897. They've only been in Bulawayo for 4 years. They're building like this. And 1890s, people traveling by stagecoach and ox wagons. This is what town looked like. Talk about traffic jams. And by 1899, they already had a railway line between Umtali and Salisbury, opened with great jubilation. I mean, this is fast. They really built fast. Advanced Rhodesia. And then they've got to get across the Zambezi. Every piece of the Victoria Falls Bridge was made in England, I think in Manchester, shipped out, and it fit. How did they get the measurements right? And they even specified what time in the morning to put the last blocks in the middle, because as the sun rose, heat would increase and then it would swell. And so, and this stood. This has stood for a century, and it's continuing to have trains, trucks, and so on driving across. This is technology and how the people planned ahead. This is all part of Cecil Rhodes' vision of Cape to Cairo. You could travel in the 1950s, you could travel from Cape Town to Cairo without a passport, without a visa, without paying border duties, custom duties, in a normal car without four-wheel drive suspension. Safely, without fear. You used to be able to drive across the Congo in a normal car in 4 days. Now you couldn't do it in 4 months, not with a four-wheel drive vehicle. So change isn't always progress. Cecil Rhodes died in Cape Town, Muizenberg Cottage, 1902. Here's his funeral procession. in Bulawayo, and you can see Bulawayo is already quite built up, 1902, and his grave, which I've been to a number of occasions, what he called World's View. By the way, when a few commies wanted to remove his grave in Rhodesia, the Matabele said, "Hi, Connor, don't even think about it. He is a chief, he is an honorable man, he's one of our people, and his grave remains here, and nobody is going to touch it," they said. So these are some of the memorials for Cecil Rhodes in Rhodesia. And of course, in Cape Town, we've got Rhodes Memorial not far from us. Interesting, this is 1904, and they're traveling still in ox wagons. But look at how the town's grown in 1904 already. Just extraordinary growth. And Bulawayo, I grew up very close to here, and my home was just off the street. And here you can see opening a school in Guelo. And this man, this Portuguese explorer, he managed to get his leg bitten off by a crocodile, somehow amputated what was left, survived and walked across and reached Rhodesia. He's coming from Angola. Bulawayo had a musical and dramatic society. So there was culture amongst these miners. And vehicles coming, can only imagine, it must have seemed a bit of an anticlimax after all the cavalry and the horseworks. But you can see the British South Africa police instructors, they're looking pretty serious, polished. And the cavalry in Rhodesia was really excellent. All British South Africa police, they had the senior position always as the senior service. And this is when the royal family was visiting in Rhodesia, would be 1947, and BSAP and Honor Guard. Inspection. Not only are all these vehicles working, but they're all clean and immaculate. I mean, you won't see this in any police station in all of Africa today. And I remember this advert, and they told us, school, you can't outrun a cheetah, and you won't be able to outdrive a Jaguar. The BSAP will get you. They had these E-type Jags, and they could go fast. And the BSAP were smart, but to see these policemen in shorts, and it would have a huge area. Some of these policemen would have an area the size of Wales to care for, and they'd keep it law-abiding. They kept it. And policemen in shorts, have you ever seen anything like that before? Tough, strong. Now, they spoke about Rhodesia being a white country, but while the white soldiers were conscripted, the black soldiers were all volunteers, and there were always seven more black soldiers or policemen to every one white in Rhodesia. 7-1. Some, I think towards the end, got 8-1. And so most of the Rhodesian soldiers fighting against communists were black volunteers. That's not part of the story. And I remember seeing this on the way to school. In fact, not unusual seeing a BSAP constable leading the school children across the roads and things like that. That was not unusual. It's a great, I think the race relations in Rhodesia were the best ever anywhere in the world. I've never seen anything like it. Not before, since. But they were also tough. They weren't just smart. They weren't just crime fighters. They could fight terrorists, and they were really effective. So this is my home, Bulawayo, and that was our town hall. And again, fountains in the wilderness. This is the Supreme Court in Rhodesia, and that's a copper dome. And again, excellence. Everything they did was with excellence. The jacaranda lined trees. This is Bulawayo swimming pool. I remember swimming there often. There were many a day I'd go there every single afternoon and swim in the Bulawayo pool. And yes, it was often this full because it was hot, especially in November. I mean, you'd just about die in November in Rhodesia. It was so hot. So the pool was the place to be. And they built to last. This is Salisbury. Ian Smith often spoke about, we're fighting for Christian civilization. And Rhodesia was a Christian country. You could just see the neatness of the people and how they dressed and the civilization, how you could stop along the sides of the roads and there'd be these wonderful little picnic spots. And I mean, don't you just love those cars? We had very old cars because of sanctions. All cars were pre-1965. You didn't have an older car than that. And Rhodesia participate in rugby overseas. I think this is what hurt Rhodesia more than anything else, is not being allowed to take part in rugby and cricket overseas. But the best we could do is play against Southwest Africa and South Africa. And shooting was part of what we did at school. target practice. But the war came. From the beginning, there was terrorism, but from 1974, it got 72, it got serious, but from 74, the whole of Mozambique opened up as Portugal abandoned and the Frelimo terrorists took the whole. So we had an 80% hostile border. There was only one bridge, bike bridge, across the Limpopo with South Africa that was friendly. One friendly border. Everything else was hostile. And that was quite a war. We were being attacked on all sides. And so everyone had to do their bit in the Rhodesian Army. My brother served in the Rhodesian Army. I was too young for that. But I remember our school teacher. He would only be with us 6 months a year because 6 months in, 6 months out. And so that you'd have to have two teachers for the same position if they were men. And the Rhodesian Army had pretty tough training, pretty demanding. This is a women's corps. And some of these boys looked like, gee, they look like they should still be in school. But youngsters, already at 17, 18, Rex Tarr, many people knew him. He's a radio personality. And the Rhodesian African Rifles, outstanding. They used to be the King's African Rifles. They became the Rhodesian African Rifles. Absolutely top class. And these men not only were infantry, they were also fire force. They were deployed by helicopters into hot zones and parachutes too. Rhodesian Light Infantry were like our paratroopers in South Africa. They were like any paratroopers, very tough training, but they could be smart on parade, and they were tough as nails in the field. Also, cheater. And you can see these men were not to be messed around with. They deployed into the field. Notice the dispatcher here on wearing his shorts and felt skins without socks. That's typical Rhodesian. Shorts, felt skins, no socks. And again, many of these chaps look like they should be in school. But leaping out of planes. Rhodesia's biggest airborne operation was the Chamoyo raid, which my brother was part of. They had 194 men, if I remember right, deployed by helicopter or by Dakotas. That was the total airborne capacity of Rhodesia. There was nothing in reserve. No more planes, no more airborne soldiers. 194. That's our total airborne capacity. And we were called a threat to world peace. Where in the world did you have soldiers who could go in the bush for weeks on end in shorts and survive? Thorny ground, fire force. Some of our men were deployed four times in a single day at different battles by helicopter or parachute even. And they fought long and hard. The true soldier fights not because he hates what's in front of him. He fights because he loves what's behind him. Grey scouts. We've always had cavalry in Rhodesia from the BSAP on, but right to the end of Rhodesian War, cavalry were key because tough terrain. And you've got to be able to get over those obstacles fast. And there's an advantage for the horsemen. And they could shoot from the saddle. And then the Zulu scouts, legendary force, very short time. Many of them ex-terrorists turned and joined the Rhodesian side to fight against the terrorists. The main weapon of the terrorists, landmines. Our Air Force. Air Force was smart, small numbers, but these are different types of helicopters from Huey, Alouette, whatever that was. Here you can see the Buccaneer, the Hunters, and is that the Lynx? And flying over Kariba, I'm sure. DC-3, this looks like Grand Reef, close to Mtali. Those barrels over there sort of give it away. Grand Reef was a major deployment zone for the work across the border. And these would be oil drums used up very quickly. Our top bomber was the Canberra and the Buccaneers, and this is the Hunter, the Hawker. Yeah, what a amount of weaponry arrayed. And when they, for example, attacked the terrorist camps at Westlands Farm, Green Leader, and so on, they would have been using the Hawker Hunters. And here you can see coming in, bombing Frantam. This would be what Americans called napalm. Really, it's called Frantam. One of our fighter pilots who won quite a number of awards. So this would be probably the entire airborne bomber capability of the entire Rhodesian Air Force. I don't think we had much more than that. That would be It was a small army, small air force, and the helicopters were key. I don't think we ever had more than 40 helicopters in the whole war. And most of those Alouettes, this would be a staging area on its way into Mozambique, probably for an op like the Chamorro raid. And troops would be trained to jump from the helicopter onto land. And it normally was a lot higher than that. In fact, every person who jumps up the helicopter goes higher. So if you're the last one, it's, oh. But, and notice, most of them have no socks, boots, no socks, shorts. And the men in these helicopters, what they had to do. Alouette heading off, see the gunner in the door, they call it a K car or a kill car. You can see a lot from up top there. And then there was the Special Air Service, Sea Squadron. The British Special Air Service still has Sea Squadron open in honor of Rhodesia. They said there'll never be another Sea Squadron. Rhodesian SAS were Sea Squadron. And they honored in Britain at Hereford too. And they would deploy behind lines into Angola and into Mozambique and so on. One of the men who served in the Rhodesian SAS was Corporal John Allen Coe, an American, whose protest against the American Vietnam War, no win war, was to go and volunteer and fight for Rhodesia for a couple of years. He was killed in action in 1975. My brother was trained in parachuting by John Allen Coe, and I remember him saying, he wondered what this crazy Yank was doing volunteering for the war. He said, you know, we conscripted this our country, but why is this American, this stupid Yank, as he put it, coming out here? And he said he's a religious fanatic. He said he kept quoting the Bible. Of course, our family was not Christian at that stage, so John Allen Coe made no sense to us then. Well, I later met his father, his mother, and his brother in Alabama, and we've got his books. We sell his books in the library. He wrote a very powerful journal showing a great understanding of what was going on in the battle. And then there's the chaplains. We know some of them. There weren't many. So the Rhodesians had three great generations. There were the pioneers, there were the builders, and the defenders. And what they achieved was extraordinary because they achieved the highest literacy rate in all of Africa, even higher than South Africa. They built dams and eradicated disease. They stopped the slaughter and intertribal genocide between the Matabele and Shona tribes in particular. They produced some of the highest yields in the world in their farms. Had some of the finest schools in Africa, produced world-class performers and athletes. They built towns, roads, railways, churches, schools, museums, hospitals, mines, art galleries, fiercely protected the wildlife, and they did all this in just 90 years. Absolutely extraordinary. I mean, an army in shorts with felskuns, without socks. This is a poster, a recruitment poster that I still see in America and Australia and so on. People have got these up, be a man amongst men, join the Rhodesian army. And they were a small army. And I've focused mainly on the men, but there were the women as well. Like this lady, Beryl Shannon, one of the women serving in Rhodesian forces. And Sally Donaldson, who is the radio talk show host, Forces Favorites and all that. She did a lot to build up the morale of the forces. And of course, the people back home were key. And the nurses, we had some of the finest nurses in the world. It was my experience being in a hospital in Bulawayo for a week. And wow, I must say, those nurses were just incredible. They made it fun to be sick. And the wives back in the farms who had to look after the farms while the man is often called up. And they were in the front line. They were being attacked. And so many a time, I remember seeing mothers in town carrying a Rogun 9mm submachine gun on their hip or revolver on the hip. Carrying these sort of Rogans was common. And those in Umtali and Manicaland, they were under regular fire. They would come under rocket fire, 122mm rockets. These are Russian-made. And this is South African, a Rhodesian engineer who dug it out to the main road. And we were only 4 miles from Mozambique, main downtown Matari, Umtali, under fire. So the people in that part of the country actually had to have bomb shelters. And it wasn't unusual seeing some Tunny with her R1 FN coming out of the bomb shelter after a bombardment. And here's the lady school principal driving in front of the students after downtown Amtali, after they'd been revved, shot up by Mozambicans. And this was not too unusual to see this kind of scene. Often the farm mother was home alone looking after the whole farm. And of course, because of landmines, they had to design all kinds of different craft that could survive landmines. The kids on the way to school in these mine-proof vehicles. That was a reality. In typical Rhodesian understatement, it is inadvisable to travel beyond this point after sunset. No jokes. And so they start to have escorts with a police vehicle with some poor soul dangling at the back of this bucky with his 50 cal machine gun, and he's the escort. I wouldn't want that job for anything, personally. I mean, feel awfully vulnerable in a position like that. And overtaking forbidden. Yes, well, obviously that's a good idea. Clive Sanders wrote this poem. Look deep in the eyes of a soldier and take note of all that you see. You will see lots of pride, a degree of respect, and a love for his family. You also see human laughter and a hint of the joke inside. And you'll also see signs of a gentleness, especially when the eyes open wide. And if you stare deep in the pupils, you will see there's a steely resolve that shows that once he's committed, there's no problem he cannot solve. But if you look that little bit deeper, past the eyes that always seem glad, you will see little hints of the things that he's seen, which occasionally make him feel sad. The things that he buries in the back of his mind, the things that he shouldn't have seen. The memories he prefers to remember blind of all the god-awful places he's been. So please understand the occasional tears and give all the support that you can, for the soldier will try to hide away fears because that's what makes him a man. This is part of our life. And more great hymns. And so all over the world, 11 November, there will be Rhodesians remembering, raising the green and white, bringing out the poppies, looking back at pictures, remembering places, battles, scenes, victories, and great comradeship, including with magnificent animals like these dogs who were a key part of the battle, and these strange Rhodesian vehicles like the crocodiles. And these were soldiers, often 19, 20, 21 years old. Grand Reef, again. Stick leader. All these people have their own stories, and they've got their own experiences with captured weapons. And this is pretty typical. My brother also cut off his sleeves. Didn't even bother to have the sleeves. And they were light. In the South African Army, we carried a lot of kit. Rhodesians carried very little. And soldiers like my brother would just have like their webbing, basic water bottles, ammo pouches, and they would camp in the bush there in the same clothes and everything without socks in their boots normally because crossing rivers for weeks on end. They operate like that. Some of our commanders, Lieutenant General Walls was commander of command operations. He served in Malaya with the SS. So that was the slogan, be a man amongst men. At Milton High School in Bulawayo, I was taught Rudyard Kipling's inspiring poem on courage and integrity. Rudyard Kipling stated he modeled his great poem, If, on the life and character of Rhodesia's Chief Justice and First Administrator, Leander Starr Jamieson. If you can keep your head while all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait, but not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, not deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good, nor talk too wise. If you can dream, and yet not make dreams your master. If you can think, and not make thoughts your aim. If you can meet with triumph or disaster, and treat those two impostors just the same. If you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the thing you gave your life to broken and stoop to build them up with worn out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch or toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss, If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they're gone. And so hold on, when there's nothing in you except the will that says to them, hold on. If you can talk to crowds and keep your virtue. If you can walk with kings, nor lose the common touch. If neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you. If all men count with you, but none too much. If you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, then yours is the earth and everything in it. And what is more, you'll be a man, my son. So that's Rudyard Kipling's famous poem, If, which we actually had to learn off by heart in Bulawayo. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Courage is not the absence of fear, but the determination to do our duty in spite of our fear. Think how David Livingstone walked 26 years across Africa, across 12 great countries, before there were bridges and roads, and alone. What courage did that take? Some rational, God-given sense of caution can protect us and our loved ones and prolong life. But if fear paralyzes us into inactivity, into neutrality, into compromise, into cowardice, or defeat and disobedience, then it is evil. Sympathy is no substitute for action, said David Livingstone. He is a man of prayer and action. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Greater love is no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Though an army may encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war may rise against me, in this I will be confident. Right in the middle of the Bible, Psalm 118, we have this. I called on the Lord in my distress and he answered me. I will not fear what man can do to me. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put your confidence in man. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put your confidence in princes. That's smack in the middle of the Bible. Better to trust in the Lord than to put your confidence in man. Well, we learned that in Rhodesia. Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid of them. For the Lord your God, he is the one who goes with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. In Britain, on 11th of November, in the grounds of Westminster Abbey, which is right opposite the road from Westminster, Palace of Westminster, the House of Commons, House of the Lord, people have planted poppies in remembrance of the different Rhodesian regiments who served. We can see there, Rhodesian Army, Rhodesian Air Force, Special Air Service, Zulu Scouts, Artillery, and all the others, support units, BSAP. This man of the Rhodesian Light Infantry became the model for this memorial, the Rhodesian Light Infantry's Trooping Memorial. On it, the words of our Lord Jesus, John chapter 15, verse 13. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. There are magazines like Rhodesians Worldwide and Facebook pages that try to keep contact with Rhodesians. They're literally worldwide. There's some books that give you an insight into some of the life during the war. The Rain Goddess, Whispering Death, A Time of Madness. Contact is one of the classics. See you in November. I actually got contact with Taffy, who's the SS chap that this book's story is about. He worked in Zambia. One of his friends, Ian Sutherland, who's now a farmer in Natal, was locked in the very same cell I was in, Lusaka Central Prison, ahead of me, of course. I remember as a teenager, maybe I was 16, seeing a picture of Ian Sutherland, bearded, chained, shackled, walking through the streets being beaten by Zambians with AK-47s. And I thought, well, how could he ever let himself be captured? I'd never let myself be captured. And 10 years later, to the day I was being led through the streets of Lusaka, barefoot, chained, and put in the same cell Ian Sutherland had been put in. The story's in See You in November. The saints on the Rhodesian Light Infantry, Masadoja, Rhodesian African Rifles, sabotage and torture, Contact 2, the Zulu Scouts, the elite story of the Rhodesian Light Infantry, Africa's commandos on the Rhodesian Light Infantry, Viscount Down. You can go to Voortrekkerhoogte in Pretoria and see the memorial to commemorate the lives of 107 holidaymakers and crew who were murdered in these two SAM-7 missile attacks on Rhodesian civilian aircraft. back in 1979 and 78. And so these are some of the details. And Bitter Harvest, The Great Betrayal by Ian Smith are two of the, some of the finest books I've read on what was going on then. It was our privilege to know Ian Smith. So that's a lot of what makes people proud to be Rhodesians. And the hymn, Rise of Voices of Rhodesia. Our flag, we've got a copy of those outside. You can see in many people's homes, a lot of memorials of different badges, units, the old SR, RSR, Southern Rhodesia symbol, and the different uniforms, weapons, the badge, the flag. But most important, it's the land, the people, the wildlife, the baobab trees, these great scenes. So any questions, any comments on 11th of November, Rhodesia?
I'd like to ask, when you went to the cemetery last time to bury Stephen, we saw that big like memorial.
Yes.
Is it also from the
That was mostly the First World War. Exactly same, First World War. South African soldiers, Springbok Legion, who were involved in the First World War. That's correct.
All those ceramic poppies, was that just an event or was that a permanent memory?
That was a temporary event. And after 11th of November 2014, so it was just up for those 4 months, the people came to collect them. Now, the flying section, that went around the country as a to be seen in different parts, and now it's in some cathedral, I think at the northernmost point in the British Isles. They've put it in the cathedral there to commemorate the men who died in the air, but the rest have gone to people's homes. People paid for them, collected their poppies, and they must be displayed all over, probably not just around Britain.
And what did you call those channels?
The trenches, yes. Those are permanent.
Where are those?
That's in Belgium, Ypres, Hill 60, very famous. You can go to Hill 60. And in fact, there's a good friend of ours who's a Kwasibantu member up in Ypres who has a group called Frontline Tours. It's even got our type style of Frontline, and he takes you around the battlefronts. And I've been taken by him to Waterloo, Ypres, and a whole host of other battle sites. And I've been there many a time, especially leading up to the 2014 memorials. I was with him again last year, getting to some of these battle sites during the Reformation 500. He organized a lot of Reformation 500 things. So there's a Christian who's having people come from all over the world. He has people often on the anniversary of their grandfather's death or something like this. They'll come out and they'll ask him to take them to where his their grandfather fought and so on, and they will. He does a research, and then he'll do tailor-made tours for people in his sort of van, and he'll take them right to the different sites. And you can imagine what an opportunity this is for witnessing too. He gets to pray with the people, share with them, and he will, for example, get to a place and might read a psalm or read the prayers that are on some of the memorials and some of the scriptures on many of the graves. And for many of these people, he said he comes, some people come there and they've got a Christian faith, but others come. He says, you know, for example, there's this person from Australia and he comes to his grandfather's grave and he cracks open a beer and has some and pours some on the grave. And you think, you know, is that the best some poor souls can do? But the poor chaps, some of them, they don't know how to handle it. So, but what a good position for a Christian with sensitivity to be in that position. And of course, with the 100th anniversary of First World War, there's been a great resurgence of interest. People have dug up in there. You know, I had a grandfather, great-grandfather was there, and people make a pilgrimage from Canada or whatever. So extraordinary. But I've been around a bit. I was staggered at just my family's links in. When I went there, I didn't know how many of my family had fought in the Battle of Waterloo. You get then, I mean, he'll pull up the research and this and the other, and you suddenly find out, whoa, you know, I didn't know we had people at this battle or that site. But to have seen a battle where my family, Lindemans and Hammonds, were side by side fighting against the French, then you had another time where they were on opposite sides, and then they were playing football and celebrating Christmas together. And you think, this is just, how do we understand this sort of thing? Our society, you know, the kind of enemy I've fought in my life has been communist atheists. The idea that you'd fight fellow Christians who'd share the same carols and hymns, it's just staggering. I understand fighting an atheist. How did Christians ever come to fight one another? If they could have seen what would happen to their countries, they wouldn't have fought against one another. They would have fought together against the right enemy. So for me, it's been very meaningful to just go through all these experiences and the battle sites.
The other thing I was wondering about, you know, that bird. I'm almost certain we have it in the Zimbabwe flag, and I don't know if anybody knows what it is. And do you know what it is in the Zimbabwe flag?
The Zimbabwe.
Yes.
From the ruins.
Is it the same as...
It's exactly the same.
Oh, from the ruins. And is that the same bird that's there?
We had the same in Rhodesian flag as they've got in their Zimbabwe flag.
Okay.
They've got that same Zimbabwe bird.
I just wondered if it were, okay.
We had a pick indicating work. They've got some kind of AK-47.
That's a
yes-a-ho. But the politicians give the credit to the discovery of Zimbabwe ruins to the local people. I don't believe it was ever built by the local people.
It's impossible.
Arabs or somebody.
Yes.
The stonework and everything was so sophisticated. The whole setting out of it was never local people.
In fact, there's a similar type of building design, and even that mosaic in Aden, in the area what today is called Yemen. And so many people believe that could have been the Queen of Sheba could have come from about Yemen area. That makes sense. Now, the idea that it could have been some Arabic or Phoenician traders that had come in there, they have to have been foreigners because it's totally defensive. You wouldn't build walls that high unless you're a small minority in an area where there's foreigners. And the Acropolis is totally for defensive purposes. And often you go in, and not just narrow, but often low. So you've got to go under here, like in the Acropolis, to get up. Of course, a person can just stand there, gonk. Each person comes through. It's totally a defensive perimeter. And it's got layers of it. So the idea that the local people built to indicate the first communist society. And so you go there and you see... the official story is they had these big stone walls and they had mud huts in the middle with thatch roofs. Why? If you could build like that, why would you live in a mud hut with thatch roof? And why would you need such big walls? And they're saying today, no, it was to symbolize communism, the first communist society. Well, yes, different imaginative rubbish, but... but... Also in there you find the coins. They've got on display in the museum. Coins that come from everywhere, from Phoenicia, Malaysia, up in Arabic areas. So plainly, the people who came there were traders. And they were a minority. And they felt for their safety or they wouldn't have built such an elaborate defensive method. The stones even come from far away. They're not even local stones. It's a real mystery. You can see when the first people went there and they started to speculate, you can understand why King Solomon's mines grew in Sir Rider Haggard's mind and maybe Queen of Sheba and, you know, those. But you go there and you feel like you're going back centuries and you just, it's a wonderful place of mystery to just start thinking through your possibilities. And I looked and I could just see this is a total defensive premises. It's got no other purpose. The people there must have felt threatened by the local people and outnumbered, or they wouldn't have gone to such extraordinary efforts.
My other question, you say that Rhodesia was like a mixture of Mozambique and Zimbabwe.
Well, no, the Portuguese did come in and did try to take or establish trade or something, but they sent conquistadors on. Considering they all died, it's hard to know what they were going there for. But they were making contact with Monomotapa, who had a kingdom in that area, mostly around the Shona area in the north. And the Portuguese, because of malaria and tsetse flies, they didn't survive. There's, I don't know how many survivors, but there's very, very few. It was effectively destroyed. So the Portuguese ignored there, and they took the coastlands. But later, they took Manicaland. And that would be somewhere 19th, 19th century. And it's that what thought, we don't just want the Mashonaland and Matabeleland, we want Manicaland. Manicaland is the third part that made up modern-day Zimbabwe, or what was then Rhodesia. And interesting how they just decided to go in and get that from the Portuguese. And the Portuguese weren't ready. There was just a few of them running around there with muskets or something. And so these well-organized British South Africa police were really like Cecil Rhodes' private army. They went in there super fast, got what they wanted in a matter of, just a matter of a couple of days or so. And before you knew it, they had the Highlands, which is the best part. Interesting enough, the British got all the Highlands, Malawi, Zimbabwe, and so on. The Portuguese got the lowlands, which is more malaria-ridden. Interesting. The British went for... That's why Nairobi is where it is, because it's over a mile high. Same with Salisbury, Bulawayo, all high up above the malaria areas. That's where they made the habitations. So the British wanted highlands, and basically Portuguese ended up with the lowlands.
And how could the horse survive in the malaria area, like in Rhodesia? Like all these horses?
Well, they couldn't survive very well. There's some parts that they couldn't get to at all. Couldn't. When I was being bitten by mosquitoes and tsetse fly, the game ranger at Mushendike said to me, praise God for the tsetse fly and the mosquito. He said, that's where our game reserves are. That's where the nature sanctuary is. The farmers can't use it. So they said, being bitten by a tsetse fly, a small price to pay for magnificent game reserves like Mushendike, Wanky, and Sabi Sabi. I've seen some artwork of David Livingstone riding on a horse in Africa. So that's totally ahistoric. He never rode on a horse in Africa. And no horse would survive where he went anyway. So that's nonsense. Anyway, there's evidence about how he walked and the distance he walked and the speed he walked and how the locals compared his speed with how theirs is. But, you know, so many people don't know what happened, don't do research, and they have some imagination. Well, he must have ridden. They put artwork there, but it's not even true.